Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We produce the show in Connecticut, where over the past few weeks there have been several arrests made over threats to members of the state legislature and court authorities. At issue have been hot-button issues like abortion, immigration, gay rights, church finances, and the Middle East. And while the internet has revolutionized political organizing, some of the tactics and messages are actually part of a longer history of right-wing organizing. It includes bullying, fear-mongering, and the use of fear tactics to try to intimidate more moderate voices. Messages often seem to be about political issues, but in the background lurk special interests, corporations, and ambitious politicians who are providing support. Over the next half hour, we continue our discussion with Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates in the Boston area. Last time, Chip Berlay explained that right-wing radio show host Michael Savage may have referenced German society under the Third Reich and Weimar Republic, but he was actually revisiting old rationalizations about the scapegoating of gays, immigrants, and other vulnerable groups dating back to the early John Birch Society organizing tactics.
This is something that goes way back to the early John Birch Society in the late 1950s, 59, 1960, where they developed the theory that liberalism, because of its decadence and its moral relativism, was going to destroy America, just like you saw with the previous historic civilizations.
And then journalist Max Blumenthal joins us to discuss the arrest of Harold Hal Turner for inciting injury to persons or property.
Which indicates that Hal Turner is an agent provocateur. Even if he is, he's still inciting violent neo-Nazi elements which have killed before. Hal Turner's called for my assassination, so I'm sure that I wouldn't doubt that the charges are true.
Turner was charged in the state of Connecticut for threats he made as he urged readers of his blog to take up arms against Representative Mike Lawler and Senator Andrew McDonald. President Obama asked both sides in the abortion debate to come together over efforts to reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies. We asked Chip Berlay to comment on what he had said.
I think the Obama administration has followed up what it did during the election campaign by crafting a very specific model of seeking the reduction of unwanted pregnancies. And I think that that's a very good way to put it, because it puts it in a framework that is a human rights framework, in which you talk about abortion then as one element of a larger strategy of reducing unwanted pregnancies. So the issue is not reducing abortions. The issue is reducing unwanted pregnancies, which results in a reduction of abortions. If you start out by saying the target is reducing abortions, the very first thing that happens by that frame is you stigmatize abortion, when in fact it's a human right. It's a basic right for women. So I don't want to be part of any compromise or common ground that starts out by liquidating the basic human rights of a constituency of our country. You see the same thing with people who talk about homosexuality. You know, it's not okay to talk about gay marriage. You know, let's talk about other things. Well, if there are basic human rights in society, they should apply to everyone. That includes women and gay people. What you see now with some centrist Democrats, okay, who are backsliders on these issues, they're willing to negotiate away basic human rights for women and gay people. And they've started by negotiating away basic human rights for women. And they have started out a dialogue with anti-abortion activists who want to end abortion rights entirely. And they have agreed on the common ground of reducing the number of abortions. This is folly. This is adopting the right-wing frame again. I understand that when you're in Washington, you might get tempted to negotiate with people. But, you know, a basic rule of organizing among progressives is that you don't enter into coalitions and compromises by stabbing your existing allies in the back. I think there's been some serious mistakes among some very well-meaning people inside the Beltway. But I think it's very important to say common ground and dialogue is good. Negotiating away basic human rights is bad. So I have no problem talking to people who are anti-abortion. I get invited to some fundamentalist Christian settings where I'm talking to people who are anti-abortion, but I'm talking about other issues like apocalypticism or hate groups or bigotry. And I say up front, we're going to have to agree to disagree on the issue of abortion. You know, people who are anti-abortion, that's a view protected by the First Amendment. But basic human rights are not something that we then throw into the pile for negotiating. There's a big difference. And so I think what you're seeing now is centrist Democrats and skillful organizers on the political right around the issue of abortion trying to sucker punch well-meaning people in the Democratic Party and in progressive religious activism to basically sell out a whole sector of society. And I don't think people realize that that's what's happening. So this is an ongoing discussion. I've been struggling with some very decent people in a number of progressive religious organizations to try and say this is not the right way to do things. I've made some missteps and I have apologized for them because, you know, I do tend to get a little hysterical sometimes. So if my hyperbolic criticism of this compromise plan has wounded people, I've tried to step back from that. But I think the issue here is clear. Right-wingers who are out of power right now are trying to find ways to lure the people who are closer to power to move them into a common language and common ground in a way that is not acceptable. So yes, dialogue, absolutely. Finding commonality. I've worked with anti-abortion people around sex education programs in schools by talking about, let's set aside some of the hot button issues, but what are things that both pro and anti-abortion parents can agree on in terms of the context of teaching about sexuality and pregnancy in schools? And when you say, let's set aside what makes everyone the angriest, condoms, there's a lot of hot button issues. Let's put those off the table and say, what can we say? Can we teach about how HIV is spread? Let's do that. Can we teach about how, you know, women get pregnant? Don't laugh. Some young women don't know. Can we teach about the basic facts of life from a scientific perspective? Most people say yes. Can we throw out of the curriculum the things that are not scientifically valid? Well, sure, why not? So it's easy to find common ground in settings where you're trying to reach to areas where there's common agreement. But that's different from immediately starting out a conversation by giving the other side everything they want. I mean, what kind of negotiator does that? It's just not smart.
In April and in early May, we were hearing that Homeland Security was warning of potential violence from the right wing. Then there was violence at Jewish temples in New York and in Connecticut. What should people of faith, people who go to temple or to the Christian churches, think about all of this and how it affects them? How can we understand what's going on here and what should be done about it?
The government report about potential right-wing violence was a report that made a good point in terms of it being a period when right-wing violence is possible. But the report itself lumped together all sorts of conservative and right-wing activists who have never broken any law and have never suggested any law be broken. So I immediately spoke out against that report, even though I had just written for the Progressive a warning that, you know, this was a period where people had to have heightened security concerns because of the potential for right-wing attacks. But, you know, the government should not be in the business of looking at conservative and right-wing people whose rhetoric and whose actions do not fall outside the law. And I think that that's a very important issue. And it's not okay to tell the government to go after everyone in the sovereign citizen movement now. It's not okay to tell the government it's okay to round up all the militant anti-abortionists. It's not the job of government to enforce our political struggles. It's the job of government to enforce the law. And, you know, the murder of Dr. Tiller is a violation of law. So let's prosecute that. But let's be very careful that we don't give the government power against the right that it will turn around immediately and use against us. The other thing is this question of the rise and fall of both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And at Political Research Associates, we have a project now studying how Islamophobia and anti-Semitism interact in our society and sort of feed on each other in a kind of heightened form of rhetoric and demonization. And so, yes, it's true for both Muslims and Jews in the United States right now that they are more at risk than they have been in certain periods of U.S. history for being lumped separately in a kind of model of conspiracy allegation. And for Jews, it's, you know, they run the U.S. foreign policy. The Mossad is, you know, basically is behind everything that's bad in the United States and the government. You know, there's all of these conflations where it's very difficult to have a very serious critique of the wrongdoing of the government of Israel without having someone then try to expand that into an anti-Semitic stereotype. So people who are critics of Israel need to be very, very careful that they don't allow that criticism to leap over into historic anti-Jewish conspiracy theories. And at the same time, the government of the United States, and let's talk about Mr. Lieberman in Congress with his hearings, that is a parade of Islamophobic so-called experts and government studies that stereotype Muslims and the kinds of attitudes towards not just Muslims, but Arabs as well, who are conflated with Muslims and in another form of stereotyping, that we see our own foreign policy expert arena split between people who talk about the late Huntington's clash of civilizations versus people who say, let's have a foreign policy that looks at Israel, that looks at the Muslim countries in the Middle East and the Arab countries in the Middle East from a sane and calm perspective and reach out to them in a way that builds a common ground again, a common ground built around common purpose that could build stability in that region. So you can look at these government collection of data that where you'll see anti-Semitism and Islamophobia going up and down over time. I think right now, even though some statistical work shows some variation in this, that we are at a period when anti-Semitic stereotyping and anti-Muslim and Islamophobic stereotyping and even anti-Arab prejudice thrown in is a problem that we all need to be sensitive about.
Chip Berlay is author of Right-Wing Populism in America, Too Close for Comfort, and editor of Eyes Right, Challenging the Right-Wing Backlash. Both received a Gustavus Meyer Center Award for Outstanding Scholarship on the subject of human rights and bigotry in North America. You can learn more about Chip Berlay's work and about Political Research Associates at publiceye.org. There have been a total of 3 arrests in Connecticut on charges relating to threatening politicians. Dominic Vita, former vice president of Connecticut's chapter of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, was arrested on charges relating to an email he sent in which threatening words were used about State Senator Tony Boucher, a Republican from the 26th District. Vita has since apologized. He said he made an error as he sent out this email, that the letter about Boucher was written in jest. But the Connecticut chapter of NORML has lost its national affiliation over this incident. And Connecticut teacher Timothy Kane was arrested. He has now apologized as well for threatening lawmakers. He completed an anger management course. Kane's threats were eerily similar to those of the third man arrested on Connecticut charges. Harold Hal Turner of North Bergen, New Jersey, apparently urged listeners and readers of his blog to take up arms against Representative Mike Lawler and Senator Andrew McDonald. Max Blumenthal joins us next to talk about Hal Turner. Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and author of a forthcoming book on the Republicans titled Republican Gomorrah. His articles and video documentaries appear in The Daily Beast, The Nation, Huffington Post, Salon.com, Al Jazeera English, and many other publications. Max Blumenthal begins a June 3, 2005 story in The Nation magazine by saying, quote, "This year, a man named Hal Turner sat before his computer at his suburban home in North Bergen, New Jersey, posting bomb-making tips on his website, hailing the firebombing of an apartment containing, quote, savage Negroes, and calling for the murder of immigrants. Quote, when enough illegal aliens get killed, they will stop coming to the country," Turner wrote. The title of the piece refers to Fox Network's Sean Hannity. It is Hannity's Soulmate of Hate. Max Blumenthal, just give us an overview of this 2005 story.
The reason that I did the piece was I thought it was important to recognize that one of the major voices of the Republican Party's propaganda machine, Sean Hannity, who is a top-rated broadcaster for Fox News and Fox Radio, used Hal Turner, who would call in as Hal from North Bergen, and he would use Hal Turner as a cudgel against black people, use them to attack minorities and mock them. And not only that, they had a close friendship off-air to the extent that Sean Hannity allegedly counseled Hal Turner on overcoming his cocaine addiction and homosexual tendencies during a private phone call. He brought Hal Turner and his family backstage to Hannity and Combs when the show first started. And then when Hal Turner became a liability and became openly neo-Nazi and began affiliating with, you know, the violent thug element of the neo-Nazi fringe, only then did Sean Hannity cut him off. Before then, Hal Turner was a pal of Sean Hannity. There's only a short distance between the language that Sean Hannity's used and the language that Hal Turner uses. Sean Hannity's hostility to minorities is couched behind Republican code words. The language Hal Turner uses is naked racism. That's the principal difference between these two former friends.
But you write in your story that there was another reason Sean Hannity dumped Hal Turner. That had to do with a political race that Hal Turner was entered in Hudson County, right?
That was the point when Hal Turner said he became radicalized when the Republican Party, he was running for a House seat in the district around Bergen County. And the Republicans, it's a diverse district, can't really win a race against a Democrat there. If you're running a hard right Republican position, so the Republican Party threw its support behind a dark-skinned Latino woman, and Hal Turner blamed this, what he considered racism, for the destruction of his political ambitions, and then he shifted to the neo-Nazi right when he was once sort of a low-level Republican official in Bergen County and, you know, an active member of Sean Hannity's radio community.
This man, Hal Turner, has been, as you know, arrested on charges of inciting violence, threatening representatives in Connecticut's legislature and members of the court here. What do you make of those charges? I know there have been comments on various websites, the Southern Poverty Law Center, about Hal Turner working as an informant for the FBI as well. Can you just sort of explain the inconsistencies in this man's credentials and history?
Well, Hal Turner's called for my assassination, so I'm sure that I wouldn't doubt that the charges are true. He publicly called for my death, I think, several times. That's the way he talks. He may well be an agent provocateur of the FBI, and there is evidence that Southern Poverty Law Center produced. I think it actually came from some bloggers allegations were brought to light by fellow neo-Nazis who discovered that Hal Turner was forwarding messages to FBI agents, and they actually produced the messages, and that he turned in someone who seemed to have a serious plot to murder the senator from Wisconsin, the Democratic Senator Russ Feingold, which indicates that Hal Turner is an agent provocateur. Even if he is, he's still inciting violence against people, and he's still making life difficult for people, inciting violent neo-Nazi elements, which have killed before, to murder people, and he's releasing home addresses of lawmakers and judges, and he's releasing phone numbers. So let's say someone does get killed, and Hal Turner is an agent provocateur of the FBI. What's the difference? The only difference is that the FBI has to take responsibility for its role in inciting this violence and working with someone as dangerous as Hal Turner. And they have consistently worked with people like that in the past. They did it through COINTELPRO against the left during the 1960s and early 70s. So I don't doubt that this is happening, but it's still a huge problem. Beyond that, the FBI should be, there should be freedom of information requests so that the FBI releases all of its files on Hal Turner if he's going to be put on trial. Their role needs to come to light. And if they have a greater role than we know, it's a major scandal, and people should be, and there should be a congressional hearing on what the FBI has been doing, because if they were involved with Hal Turner, they were a catalyst for threats against all of these lawmakers.
Hal Turner also apparently endorsing the recent murder of Dr. George Tiller.
You expect Hal Turner to endorse this? You know, what's interesting is the lack of denunciation from the official, big fish of the Christian right, or from the rhetoric of Operation Rescue founder Randall Terry, who I interviewed the other day, who said we shouldn't blame Scott Roeder or we shouldn't blame Operation Rescue for this killing. We should blame Moses, because Moses said, "Thou shalt not kill," and George Tiller was a mass murderer, therefore he deserved what he got. That's what Randall Terry said. At the same time, he refuses to take any responsibility for the death, but if he's saying one abortion doctor deserves what he gets, then, you know, this next abortion doctor who his Operation Rescue cadres are targeting will also deserve what he gets. Therefore, Randall Terry, you know, who's doing press conferences at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and is on the phone with reporters like me all the time, is inciting assassination of healthcare professionals. And he has been responsible, at least indirectly in the past, for assassination. James Kopp, who worked out of Randall Terry's Binghamton, New York office, was the assassin of Barnett Slepian. You know, who are the guys who were in Barnett Slepian's front yard? You know, Barnett Slepian was in a Buffalo-based abortion provider. They were Rob and Paul Schenck. They were heads of Operation Rescue, and they went around with Randall Terry. They were detained at one point with Randall Terry for dangling aborted fetuses in Bill Clinton's face at the Democratic National Convention. I mean, these are sick characters. Right now, Rob Schenck and Paul Schenck are ministering to Republican congressmen in the Capitol. They have an office set up across from the Supreme Court, and Republican staffers go and pray in their offices every day. I've visited there, and I know Rob Schenck. And they gained a special security clearance a week before Barack Obama's inauguration through a congressman named Paul Brown to anoint the door to the inaugural walkway that Barack Obama would walk through. So these people, you know, the Christian right isn't dead. These people who've been intimately connected to the assassination of healthcare providers are getting special security clearance in the Capitol and maintain intimate connections to Republican members of Congress. And it reflects a greater trend, which is that the Republican Party is more dominated by these elements than it ever has before. All the moderate forces that served as a check on these elements are gone. They've all been voted out or moved to the Democratic Party. So what you're seeing now is not just through Hal Turner or Randall Terry, or not just some fringe extremist. You're seeing the forces that have driven the Republican Party to the far right, marginalized it, but maintain a degree of influence that's genuinely dangerous.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal. You can find his articles and videos online at maxblumenthal.com, and you can find his work on politics, the media, the evangelical right wing, and other subjects at Huffington Post, The Nation, and other blogs, as well as Media Matters, where he was a research fellow. That's mediamatters.org. Max Blumenthal, what about the defense Hal Turner's lawyer is making in Connecticut, claiming Turner is merely exercising his right to free speech?
Yeah, I'm not a legal expert, and I hope the United States remains the freest country in the world. I'm not in favor of regulating speech as they do in Europe. I don't think Hal Turner's speech threatens our democracy. But when you start publishing addresses of lawmakers and calling for their assassination, you should at least be investigated. And again, there needs to be an investigation into what the role of the FBI is in this as well. We're going to see these sort of campaigns of incitement and murder as a result. We're going to see that intensify in the coming years because the Republicans are out of power and the far right no longer has any means of exerting its influence on government. So their only way, or one of the means of acting and venting their frustrations, is through domestic terrorism. We saw it in the 90s. We're going to see it more and more. And friends of mine like Dave Neiwert, you know, the blogger or Sinus, who's an expert on domestic terrorism, he was mocked by Andrew Sullivan for making this prediction one day before George Tiller's murder. And so I think there's going to be a lot of backpedaling of people who say this is just paranoia. So there has to be some sort of legal means of preventing this. And that's why during the 90s, you know, the Justice Department did the RICO Act to prevent Randall Terry and his people from getting close to clinics and, you know, abortion doctors' houses. They used the same method they used against the mafia, against domestic terrorist-linked anti-abortion groups, and it worked. So there has to be some legal measure, but I don't think regulating speech is the answer, and I don't think what happened with Hal Turner is just a speech issue.
It was reported on Democracy Now! That staff at a clinic alerted the authorities that Scott Roeder tried to superglue their clinic doors shut twice over 2 weeks prior to the killing of Dr. Tiller, he could have been in federal custody long before the shooting.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't see why people who are implementing these tactics aren't being monitored more closely, except that the Justice Department under Bush redirected its focus to environmental extremists like Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. And the FBI and Department of Homeland Security identified these groups, which only destroy property and don't actually attack people, as the primary domestic terrorist threat, and stopped monitoring anti-abortion groups. And, you know, John Ashcroft, who is a close friend of the guy I named before, Rob Schenck, who camped out on the assassinated abortion doctor Barnett Slepian's lawn, who actually prayed with Rob Schenck and sang gospel music in his home with Rob Schenck, was the attorney general for something like 4 years. You know, so there was a rollback in, you know, attempts to limit the threat of anti-abortion extremists. And I don't know what's going on at the Justice Department now, but, you know, hopefully there will be more attention. The tactics that Scott Roeder was using before he killed George Tiller are detailed and advised in a manual that's distributed by the Army of God. Every anti-abortion terrorist has been affiliated with the Army of God, which is a, they organize it according to the model of the leaderless resistance, which means this manual just goes around, but it's not distributed officially by any organization. And this manual is the only link to the organization. And the manual advises all kinds of tactics, from property destruction to harassment to assassination and means of assembling explosives. You know, it's still going around. It's still out there, and it's online at the Army of God's website. And so that needs to be recognized, too, that there is a, I hate to use the word conspiracy, but there are people who are conspiring to do violence against abortion doctors, but they do so through very covert means, so they're hard to identify except by their tactics.
Max Blumenthal, I know right now you're very jet-lagged from your trip to Israel. You've just returned. I hope you'll join us to talk about that trip and also about your forthcoming book, Republican Gomorrah. What is it about?
My book, which is coming out late this summer, chronicles, you know, how the Christian right took over the Republican Party and eventually drove it to the margins and shattered the party. It's called Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And I also tell my story of covering this movement for 5 years.
Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Max Blumenthal's website is maxblumenthal.com, and he has agreed to join us again to talk about his trip to Israel and Gaza. We taped our interview with Max Blumenthal at 1 p.m., Even as we were talking on the phone, news was breaking about a 12:50 p.m. shooting at the nation's capital. We would later learn that a white supremacist named James W. Von Bruen, age 88, shot and killed security guard Stephen Tyrone Johns, age 39, an African American. Johns had been at the museum for 6 years, and according to AP, he was from Temple Hills, Maryland. The Holocaust Museum's director, Sarah Bloomfield, said Johns died heroically in the line of duty. Von Braun was also shot, and he is listed in critical condition at an area hospital. President Barack Obama issued a statement saying he was shocked and saddened by the shooting. He added, quote, "This outrageous act reminds us that we must remain vigilant against anti-Semitism and prejudice in all its forms. No American institution is more important to this effort than the Holocaust Museum." President Obama goes on to say, "No act of violence will diminish our determination to honor those who were lost by building a more peaceful and tolerant world." We produced several radio specials this week, a call to impeach torture lawyers, that airing on Pacifica's Sprouts, our interview with philosophy professor and U.S. military veteran for peace, Camilo Mack Bica, how the Afghan War will become Obama's Vietnam, Connecticut Governor Jody Rell's veto of an act that would have abolished the death penalty in Connecticut, and more. You can find links to these and other programs at our website, talknationradio.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. The show's taped at Talk Nation Radio Studios in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio@gmail.com with your comments.